United Nations Conference on Trade and Development is scheduled to take place in Ghana from 20th to 25th of April 2008. The conference, under the theme Addressing the Opportunities and Challenges of Globalization for Development, will be attended by about 4,500 representatives from 193 states, including several heads of state, as well as participants from other international bodies, non-governmental organizations, business, and academia. Our presidents from Brazil, Algeria, Finland, El Salvador, Nigeria, Senegal, Tanzania, and Turkey, amongst others, have confirmed their participation in this conference. Now, we've heard about it. We've got to know about it. Today, there's going to be a flag-raising ceremony of the UNCTAD, but we want to do a further analysis of this conference and how it's going to impact on our economy, the developing countries, the continent, of course, the parts of the world. And to help me do this, I've just been joined in the studio by Mr. Franklin Kudjo. He's with the Imani Center for Policy and Education. Mr. Franklin Kudjo, thank you very much for your time this morning, and thank you for joining us in the studio.
It's a pleasure.
Very well. Now, for the sake of education and information, when we talk about globalization, what is globalization in its entirety?
Well, thank you very much. I think globalization, a layman's explanation of globalization would be when goods and people actually transcend borders. I mean, the interaction between goods and people transcending all known borders. That would be my layman's explanation. In fact, I can even refer to a French economist, journalist at some time, I think the latter part of the 19th century, who said that, well, when goods and people fail to cross borders, soldiers will. Well, that is to underscore the fact that, we've come a long way, and in actual fact, if people and commodities do not interact, do not go beyond known barriers or borders, what it means is that there could be trouble. Because again, as we are seeing, even with the food crisis all over, yeah, I mean, these kinds of examples can be explained, yeah.
And I'm just asking you this question because of the theme for the conference, addressing the opportunities and challenges of globalization for development. And has Ghana really benefited immensely from globalization as compared to other African countries, by your own explanation?
Well, I think Ghana has. There are people who think that globalization has become more of a threat, has become a devil's wheel, bandwagon, rather than, given the kinds of benefits that we otherwise would have actually gotten from it. But I tend to differ, and I think that if we're having this discussion again because of the gadgets we have here, I mean, we don't manufacture these things here. In actual fact, we are, Ghana has come a long way, and there is a saying, in fact, politicians like to use that Ghana is like a gateway to probably West Africa, and then to the rest of the world. Now, that in itself tells you that, it does have its own connotation, but then it's also, it's the presumption, really, is that Ghana has integrated itself into the world economy to the extent that when they say gateway to West Africa, probably a link to the world, it's not just geographical. It has economic undertones. It has international relations undertones, and I think that is the way we would like to define Ghana. What have we not gained as a result of being part of the global community? Is it access to information? Is it access to the latest cars that we see on the street? Is it access to the latest gadgets in terms of research that is at our disposal? Is it access to outside markets? And is it access to technical know-how? You know, these are some rudiments of globalization. Some people have even said there is religious globalization. We have all kinds of churches here. I mean, that's not to downplay religion, but again, you can explain that on the periphery. There's the economic, the political, and of course the social and religious dimensions of globalization. And Ghana has benefited a lot.
I would have wished that you go on to some practical benefits that Ghana has, you know, got from globalization in itself. You mentioned, you know, are we having some other goods that we import which are not manufactured here, which helps our industries and all that to help us produce some other goods which could have been produced if these gadgets were to be, you know, manufactured here. Wouldn't that be possible?
Well, But again, I thought I'd mention the issues of technical know-how. And so, being practical here, what kind of samples can I give? There are just too many of them that I pinpointing one in particular. Let's just say that in any case, globalization comes with the transmission of information, right? So let's use even the example of information communication technology. Let's look at what has happened by opening up our country in terms of access to telecommunications or access to communication tools. Let's use the mobile phone industry, for instance. How many mobile phone companies do we have now? I'm told there's even going to be a seventh one. Now, these are people bringing in all kinds of sophisticated gadgets in order to improve telecommunication. Don't forget, telecommunication, mobile telephony, has a tremendous impact on an economy, on the economic development of a country. I'm sure you know that instead of just traveling from here to Kumasi, probably traveling to talking to a trader or a farmer on this farm, you might better do it by using mobile phones. And so it cuts drastically that heavy barrier of trying to meet physically. Now, compare these bits, infinitesimal examples of how information is helping to transform lives. And when you add all that together, look at how much that industry would bring or is bringing to the Ghanaian economy. I mean, we can talk about the corporate responsibility side of it. MTN, for instance, I'm told, has given close to $600,000 to renovate Kolebu, the children's block. That is an offshoot of allowing these kinds of processes to happen. Globalization in terms of mobile phone, mobile telephony. And of course, even $20 million that was given to Ghana for supporting its water project. Now, we can all say that, well, what has globalization done? People see globalization in the eyes of the fact that there's a lot of domination of the local markets and with foreign products. But the point is this. It is true that, really, when goods are produced cheaply somewhere, people have individual choices and they would like to go for those goods anyway. In any case, it serves nobody any good if you produce goods in your own country and when they are short, they are expensive because your own local inhibitions that are supervised sometimes by government do not allow people to have choices. I'm not saying that imported products are always good. I mean, I'm scared of certain Chinese products, for instance. I wouldn't buy them, but the fact is that given the benefit of that and given our hindsight, what can we do? Is it globalization should not just be seen in the eyes of poultry products or rice importation and all that kind of thing. In any case, if you look at the rice importation and poultry products, compare what is the cost of doing business in Ghana as compared to the cost of doing business elsewhere where these products are being brought in. If it is cheap, you and I will buy so that we can save some of the money and invest in other areas of the economy. You know, this basic understanding of economics really escapes unfortunately, a lot of so-called intellectuals in this country. And so they will tell you that globalization is so bad. Look at how our poultry industry has been affected. Well, fine. But the poultry that is being produced, there may be problems with the poultry that is imported. It may have sat in the port, probably because there are better systems of refrigeration. If you had the same scenario, you do that. So we can go on and on, really.
Exactly. It's a very interesting analysis you're making. But then from just deducing from what the analysis you're making with respect to the benefits that come with globalization, it means that maybe a country like Zimbabwe will not be benefiting from all this.
No way. That's a country that is, it's just dead. And I'm just hoping that Mugabe guy really leaves the scene. Anyway,
he's the man.
Well, he is the man. But unfortunately, I don't see why. I don't know how people survive in that country. I'm in daily constant touch with friends in Zimbabwe. And then they tell me, hey, I'm going to buy a cup of coffee for 240 million Zimbabwean dollars. I'm like, wait a minute. What are you going to do?
We had an independent observer going into that country to accept the elections. We have a first-hand information when it comes to the economic situation there, and it's really nothing to write home about. That is just by the way.
Right.
You know, so.
Right.
The theme, I'm just still getting into the theme. It's talking about opportunities and challenges. What are some of the challenges that comes with globalization?
Well, definitely, I would say that people fear globalization because of their own flaws, because of their own problems, because of the way they are not able to manage their own systems. Now, I can use one or two examples. If you're talking about multinational companies, for instance, taking over coming into a country, a poor country like Ghana, and then probably recouping all the profits away. Well, that obviously someone can say is a threat of globalization because you're allowing... Not only the brain drain. Well, we'll talk about that, but this one has to do with reparation of profits.
Yeah.
Because when multinational companies come into a country, for instance, like MTN and all these guys are here, I was trying to use the mining example. Now, then what happens is that you don't set the rules. You have to set the rules of these people. And listen, this product belongs to us. This is the way we want it harnessed.
And does not come with trade and all.
Exactly. This is how we want this product harnessed. And this, the effluence, the problems that come with what we call the externalities, the problems that come with mining must be managed with the state-of-the-art technology. Do you have it? Well, if you don't have it, then wait until you have it. We don't do that. Then, because we don't set the rules and settle for 10% kickbacks, what happens is that at the end of the day, when there are these externalities, and obviously affect the environment and the people living around, then we take a good shot at multinationals like mining companies and then ram them to the ground saying they put profits before people. That is unfortunate. That is an indictment on our own systems. Because if you don't have those systems for which people have to play the rules, these things will happen. So for me, I'm not saying I don't see any threats, but I'm saying that the threats are indexed on our own flaws, our own inability to set the pace, to set the rules. What are the rules when it comes to, again, as I said, multinationals? You have talked about brain drain. Well, the issues about...
We go there. These multinational companies come into the country with clauses for business. And in as much as Ghana's economy wouldn't like to, you know, get these people... to other countries to accommodate them
and
all the clauses they come with.
Well, what clauses? I mean, someone is coming here and of course is coming to invest. You want investment, but then you've not lost your mind. You have to set rules. There is also the issue, I understand you, that if you don't take it, well, we'll go somewhere. In any case, index that on your own ability. Do you have the wherewithal? Do you have the capacity to ensure that your own people get employed? In any case, how much do you even pay them? And when multinationals come in, and I'm not here trying to support multinationals, we're just being realists, really. It is only people who fail to see the reality who become ideologues, and I'm not one of them. But the point again is this, that really, so ask yourself, before the multinationals came in, what was the level of, how much were these people being paid? I'm not talking about probably well-trained people, but even those who do those skilled aspects of this kinds of jobs, how much are they being paid? Index it against a dollar a day, which is usually the what the UN normally would give exactly for poverty. Ask yourself, how much were they that poor? How many hours of backbreaking using hose and cutlasses probably would they have endured on a parcel of land compared with the fact that they would have been working under supposedly, even if the conditions were not too perfect, and they were given probably 3-4 times a day's wage. Now, these are some of the problems, these are some of the calculations that ought to be made really before you can say that they are problems. Then brain drain. Don't forget, as a brain drain, it is definitely, you don't have a monopoly over, you may say you train people, and I'm not saying brain drain is a good thing, but are we also looking at something we call brain circulation? Because again, these things are happening. People go...
Let me into
all right.
Of brain circulation and what you mean by...
Okay. Oh, you want me to go on? Right. Well, obviously, brain drain has been accused, as if it's a human being, of getting rid of our trained professionals. Well, why train them and then give them poor wages? Don't tell me we don't have the money. The fact is that...
That is that's the case. I mean,
well, that's the case. You don't pay them well, and you expect them. And I think some of them is not just because of the pay, but the gadgets, the technology, the instruments even used in our various health centers are poor, they are decrepit, they are just inadequate, they are not even there. So how can, after you've trained, you can claim you've spent taxpayer money to train them. Yes. So what happens? Should you just go and sit and be looking at school hospital buildings? The person needs to work. And the reason is this. You see, if we will say that we don't have money. But these people live amongst us, and they see especially how politicians wantonly display opulence. And when these things happen, they ask themselves, why couldn't politicians, for instance, agree for once that they spent just a third of the money voted for them to buy cars? Apparently, that is what they all agree on at a certain point. And then use part of that money to probably construct roads so that the bill that comes with giving them loans, they're actually grants, they're not loans, but I don't believe they pay back. And use some of these monies to rather, you know, support the infrastructure. If you don't do that, they will run away. And I tell you what, it's you know, it keeps going. But again, question is, at the tail end of it really, don't we have some kinds of skills transfer? There are some people who usually come back, who come and help and all that kind of thing. Maybe you say it's not enough. Well, I hear one time Professor Kosa, the former the very respected man, I should say, I'm not CPP, but I thought he should have been the CPP. That's according to me, because I think it's practical. And this is a guy who said that, listen, we can't fight with brain drain. What we can do, if this guy wants these people, a lot of them, we have lots of them, let's train them and probably ship them, and then we get benefits from that. We probably index it on a taxpayer, probably in the UK, the US. This is a practical. There's nothing you can do about
Ghana itself as a country would need these people. We're shipping them.
Let me tell you something. Patriotism. You don't eat patriotism, do you?
Of course you don't.
What motivates you to be in the studio today, apart from, well, your pay? I'm sure you love the job, but obviously you have been motivated to do this. Don't tell me you train me and I should hang on to the national anthem and look at it and probably say, oh, this is so beautiful, this is a beautiful country. Or as those people asking me to stay themselves, don't even know lines of the national anthem. You know, these are some of the issues we'll be looking at. And as I said, look at the bill in terms of how much politicians spend, draw so much for freely, go places, they have free bodyguards, free, not to sound so funny, but sometimes even free girlfriends, all these kinds of things. Anyway, I'm sorry, but just to tell you that it's so obscene, and these are the elephants in the room. People fail to see them, and they tend to blame all kinds of systems for our own problems. If you said globalization, excuse me, one more thing. If you blame trade regimes, really, the developed countries subsidize their product. Well, yes, they are able to do that. Probably it's bad. You don't subsidize yours as well, because it's stupid. It's foolish to subsidize either way. In any case, at the end of the day, do you even trade amongst yourself? Look at Ghana. There's food production dumped all over certain places. We can't even cut tomatoes to Accra. We have to be going for tomatoes from Burkina Faso. And we have some groups, activists, NGOs, that are so bereft, do not even understand the dynamics of this thing. And all they do is to blame some Westerners. Whereas you and I know that trading between Ghana and Nigeria, travel by road to Ghana, from Ghana to Nigeria, and see the number of blocks, the custom problems that you face. Nigeria recently banned how many products? 96 from entering their products from Ghana. Can you imagine the number of times Ghana can enter Nigeria? And we don't see these things and talk about them. And I think that was the basis of UNCTAD, really. Self cooperation.
Let me just remind listeners that you are still live on the Nation's Heartbeat and Historic Voice 2.3. We're still having the studios with me, Mr. Franklin Kujo, here with the Imani Center for Policy and Education. We're looking more ahead of this conference, United Nations Conference of Trade and Industry, the 12th meeting that's supposed to be taking place in Ghana, and it's going to be having the flag raising ceremony. We want to have a pre-conference analysis and how globalization has impacted on our economy over the years, and I think that we are making headway. Mr. Bright Akwete, Let me just find out. Mr. Franklin could just search. Let me just find out from you. This thing, an issue about if really we as a country are paying attention to a global trend. Now, do you think that as a country we are paying attention to the global trend and how it's affecting our local trend? When I talk about paying attention, I mean, have we put in place or formulated any policies to that effect to help us keep ourselves up and going when it comes to the global trend of trade and maybe development?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'd like to answer in the light of the numerous conferences attended by our government people. Not only this government, when I say government people, this is a country where people think, once you mention government, they think it's a particular one. Well, governments usually attend certain meetings, ratify all kinds of conventions, and then come back home and clasp their hands and their thighs. Nothing happens. Well, the question about whether we are really moving with the times, it's really interesting and probably funny. You know, well, let's index it on the question you asked concerning, for instance, trade. As I said, we go to these meetings like WTO meetings, probably UNCTAD meetings, and it is stressed that, listen, as individual countries, you need to facilitate trade within your communities, your respective countries. If you did that, you need to ensure that credit is given a lot to your farmers, right? You need to ensure that the cost of production, that is the importation, the import tariffs on certain products that local manufacturers will use, for instance, you need to reduce that. You need to, for instance, reduce tariffs on imported medicine. Let me not even bring that. But you need to reduce taxes and tariffs on certain components that are so vital for the production, the local capacity, local production capacity. Now, we sign to all of these things and come back home and do nothing. Today, at only 6%, and this is a figure I think we got from the Business and Financial Times not too long ago, that only 6% of all funding that is supposed to go to agriculture actually reaches agriculture. That is, of all the funding that is supposed to go into agriculture, only 6% actually reaches the agriculture sector. Isn't it funny? When you have a sector that produces close to 40% of your GDP, and as I'm told, employs close to 60-65% of the populace because of peasant famine, a lot of which we do. And gets just a paltry amount of this. And don't forget that the import duties on certain components that they'll tell you to reduce them, it's been done. But the fact of the matter is that the markups, even when it's done, the markup, before it gets to the farmer or it gets to the local manufacturer, it's so high. You understand? So this is an example of moving away from what ought to be done. And you know, don't allow yourself to be street talked by politicians. Because most of the time, the kinds of things they tell you, oh, we've reduced this thing by 25%, but then they've tightened it somewhere else. And so you don't see, look at the bill in terms of the petroleum, the taxation policy, and all that kind of thing. Look at it specifically. All these things affect the country. If you don't have the foresight to have that vision to manage your energy resources properly, so that for a whole year you were literally groping in the dark, what it means is that you have not respected these mandates that you yourself have imposed upon yourself by signing to them to ensure that your local trends actually syncs up with the global trends. So it is fine and dandy to go and sign all kinds of papers elsewhere. For instance, the latest one is the global warming.
Yeah.
You and I, ask yourself, how many, this global warming thing, what is affecting? Nothing. What happened in the north? People say it's whatever, global. If you build mud houses, what are you expecting? When the rains come, they'll go down the drain. And I don't want to say that the northerners just build mud houses. I can index this on the fact that global warming can always be solved when given the fact that technology can enhance this sort of things. Look at the tsunami that happened in East Asia. Tsunami.
Yeah.
When we had the tsunami in East Asia, look at the countries, look at the profile of the countries there. I'm making an important comment about economic development being giving attention so that some of these alarmist theories probably can be solved. We heard about the tsunami. Look at all these countries, Bangladesh, Thailand, and then one other country which are badly affected. But Thailand had high-rise buildings, so you couldn't see the impact of the tsunami so much. All these countries that were low-lying were affected, they were buried, you understand? Yeah. So in the same way, if you build good systems, good planning systems, you can always adapt to these things. But here we are, our politicians go and sign these, excuse my language, but useless pieces of papers, and then come back and get some carrots for it in terms of foreign aid.
I understand. Mm. I really don't understand your
frustrations.
Well, frustrations you call it though. But I have some text messages I think we'll have to respond to them before we wrap up. It looks like the time is really running up on that. I wish you could continue the point. This Paul texts me from Cantonment, and he says, what way did the issue of globalization of ICT system transform our security networking? Osman texts me from Odoko. He says, I want to know from your guest what globalization has come to do in terms of food security and production in Ghana. And Timo texts me from Achimota. He says, can industries that do not meet the standard of globalization on ICT have their production affected at any level? Grace texts me from Odoko. He says, the issue of globalization of global technology has come to help industry development, but there is still high rate of unemployment. Why? And Neil Ortega texts me from Togo. He says, I think globalization has rather come to increase the issue of brain drain because of high demand in the ICT sector. And
well, it's interesting. The lady who you read before the last one seems to have answered quite a number of the questions. But I think that one, if we talk about the security network and the fact that it, I think it's important to note one thing. That globalization, as we said, because it opens up the system for all kinds of information to flow, technology also to flow, it is up to you to take advantage of it. Don't forget, if this person is asking this question about the security network, I think he's trying to make certain emphasis on probably national security. Let's look at it. How do we manage our own security systems in this country? You see, if we have this global positioning systems, which I believe the police service are trying to use, it's quite expensive, but they can only work and probably be effective if we have good layout, physical layout, so that it's easier when there's an alarm system set somewhere that a crime is being committed this way. It's easier for the police to get in there and solve these things. You understand? Or probably the security here could also mean security in terms of the banking transactions and all that kinds of things. I know, for instance, that through globalization, some friends of mine, I mean, working at SoftStripe, for instance, Herman Chinarehesi and a lady friend of mine called Juna Runga, are actually in the process of bringing out a product, really, which would drive out this e-switch thing. I tell you, that product in itself, is going to cut banks, and that's why the Bank of Ghana is so scared. They have to go to these guys and tell them, be careful what you're doing. But it's a lie. The governments don't like when borders and excuse my language, darker areas are being eliminated by lights. So the problem again, the issue about security, I think maybe I'm veering off too much, but the issue of security here has to do with the fact that we probably are not taking advantage enough of all kinds of systems, technological products that are in here. Someone talked about food security. Well, wait a minute. Who said that we should be self-sufficient in food production? We should be self-sufficient in food consumption. I don't believe that we should stay agrarian forever. I mean, look, Hong Kong as a country, if you go there, it's just a rock. But Hong Kong is self-sufficient in food consumption. There's nothing there that they produce. What do? They have invested in ICT, and they actually walk the talk, not grandiose papers, ICT policy, and then it's in the newspapers for about 3 weeks and nothing happens. Now, these people have invested in technology, and they are exporting everything that I mean, it's so beautiful. So about food security, well, fine. But if, why don't you diversify your economy, make gains to be able to get food from several sources? In any case, the food security you're talking about, look at the agriculture systems. It's all peasant farming. You understand? No. Yeah. Exactly.
And but looking at the level of diversification in our economy, don't you think it's got to that extent of at least solving some of these problems?
Oh, you see, it's a chicken and egg situation. People fail to see that globalization has indeed helped to diversify and still diversify the economy. But on the levels of, it's so minute. There are just few people doing private stuff here and there. We want to see increased globalization, in fact, excessive globalization, because it is just so good for you and I. We don't have to be pinned down to eating. I'm not saying rice is produced on my hometown. It's nice, it's a brown one, but it's full of stones. You understand? Much as I would like to eat my local rice, I want it done properly, which is why I would want, for instance, rice imported, because it's cheaper and it's nicer. And it's better.
Finally, Alice, before we wrap up, it's been very, very, very insightful and educative. And with Ghana in perspective as a developing nation, do you think that we still can make much out of an enabling environment to withstand the new realities in the geography of the world economy?
Oh, for sure. You see, you definitely can enhance. I think your question is just like asking, opening up a country for business. If you look at the World Bank's report, that talks about doing business in Ghana. I mean, they tell you the hard facts. Look, how many days does it take to register a business in this country? They tell you, back door, it could be a day. Not everybody has to go through the back door. Should it be 180 days? How many days would it take you to register a property, a piece of land that you buy? Should it take you over 180 days or probably the whole year? And should it cost you about 120% of your income yearly? You know, these things have to be looked at. And when we solve these things, we'll be more than ready to enable that openness that would allow greater investments. Because I tell you, and again, we have to also look at our tax regimes. The tax systems are just too high.
And it's almost, there are so many ways that have been devised now by the Internal Revenue Service for the collection of taxes.
Well, the collection of taxes, I think that, you see, because it's a skewed system, we don't know how many people pay taxes in this country. Like the formal workers, it's less than 2 million, right? So the Internal Revenue is always looking out for ways to increase revenue. And because of their own inability to expand the revenue base, I think they've done something good, though, with the flat tax regime. But that we need to go beyond that. But that comes with what? Identifying people in the system. If 70% of your businesses are in the informal sector, how do you identify them to pay taxes? That is why they will come to you and I, who they think are formal and can be seen, and then impose elephant based type of taxation. And I'm not using elephant here because of MPP, but it's just the symbolic. Even if I did, it still tells you that a government that imposes probably too much taxes. And don't forget, the MPP is not supposed, it's not supposed to be doing that, because by their philosophy, which I believe in, by the way, is that property owning democracy comes also with, if you enhance property ownership, what it means is that everyone becomes better off. There's minimal taxation that people have to pay. People have to just think about themselves. But it has been more of a rhetoric than a reality.
Very well. It's been worth having this pre-conference analysis. Let me just say that we're very grateful to you for your time this morning and for that insight you've given to us ahead of this UNCTAD conference. Thank you very much, Mr. Franklin.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
That was Mr. Franklin. This was the Imani Center for Policy and Education, giving us a pre-conference analysis. And I believe it was worth having it.